with Tommaso. He yawned and leaned against the wall. He'd been at it for about 20 hours straight. By now, Richard Burton would have told her that she wasn't dying, that she was, in fact, pregnant. And yet he heard none of the noises he'd have expected coming from behind the door at the revelation of this news. Either a loud expression of anger, or the relief at the truth of her condition, or the shock that she was having a baby. "A baby!" she might yell, or ask, "A baby?" Yet there was nothing behind the door but hushed voices. Perhaps 5 minutes passed. Pasquale had just decided to leave when the door opened and Dee Morey came out alone, her robe pulled tight around her. She had been crying. She said nothing, just walked down the hall, her bare feet padding on the carpet. Pasquale pushed off the wall. She put her arms around his neck and hugged him tightly. He put his arms around her, the tapered notch of her waist. He felt the silk against her skin, and beneath her soft robe, her breasts against his chest. She smelled like roses and soap, and Pasquale was suddenly horrified at the way he must smell after the day he'd had. Trips on a bus and in a car and in 2 fishing boats. And only then did the unbelievable nature of this day fully register. Had he actually begun the day in Rome, nearly cast as an extra in the movie Cleopatra? Then Dee Morey began to shudder like the old motor in Tommaso's boat. He held her for a full minute and tried simply to let the minute be, the firmness of the body beneath the softness of that robe. Finally, Dee Morey pulled away. She wiped at her eyes and looked into Pasquale's face. "I don't know what to say." Pasquale shrugged. "He's okay. But I want to say something to you, Pasquale. I need to." And then she laughed. "Thank you is not nearly enough." Pasquale looked down at the floor. Sometimes it was like a deep ache, the simple act of breathing in and out. "No," he said, "is enough." He pulled from his coat the envelope of money, much lightened since it had been handed to him on the Spanish steps. "Michael Dean asked for me give you this." She opened it and shook with revulsion at the bloom of currency. He didn't mention that some of the money was meant for him. It made him feel complicit. "And these," Pasquale said, and handed her the continuity photos of herself. On top was the picture of Dee and the other woman on the set of Cleopatra. She covered her mouth when she saw it. Pasquale said, "Michael Dean said, I tell you, don't ever tell me what that bastard said." Dee Morey interrupted, not looking up from the photograph. "Please." Pasquale nodded. She still hadn't looked up from the continuity photos. She pointed to the other woman in the photo, the one with the dark hair whose arm Dee Morey was holding as she laughed. "She's actually quite nice," she said. "It's funny." Dee sighed. She flipped through the other pictures, and Pasquale realized now that in one of them she was standing grimly with 2 men, one of whom was Richard Burton. Dee Morey looked back toward the open door of her hotel room, and then she wiped her teary eyes again. "I guess we're going to stay here tonight," she said. "Richard's awfully tired. He has to go back to France for 1 more day of shooting, and then he's going to come with me to Switzerland, and we'll see this doctor together and, I guess, get it taken care of." "Yes," Pasquale said, the words "taken care of" hanging in the air. "I am glad you are not sick." "Thank you, Pasquale. Me too." Her eyes became wet. "I'm going to come back and see you sometime. Is that okay?" "Yes," he said, but he didn't think for a second that he would ever see her again. "We can hike back up to the bunker, see the paintings again." Pasquale just smiled. He concentrated, looking for the words. "The first night, you say something. that we don't know when our story is start, yes? Dee nodded. My friend, Alvis Bender, the man who write the book you read, he tell me something like this one time. He say our life is a story, but all stories go in different direction, yes? He shot a hand out to the left. You, and the other to the right. Me. The words didn't match what he'd hoped to say, but she nodded as if she understood. But sometimes we are like people in a car on a train go in same direction, same story. He put his hands together. And I think this is nice, yes? Oh, yes, she said, and she put her own hands together to show him. Thank you, Pasquale. One of her hands fell to Pasquale's chest, and they both stared at it. Then she pulled it away, and Pasquale turned to leave, summoning every bit of pride in his body to wear on his back like the shield of the centurion he'd almost become that morning. Pasquale, she called, after only a few steps. He turned, and she came down the hallway and kissed him again. And although it was on the lips this time, it was not at all like the kiss she'd given him on the patio outside the hotel Adequate View. That kiss had been the beginning of something, the moment when it felt like his story was beginning. This was an end, the simple departure of a minor character. Him. She wiped her eyes. Here, she said, and she pressed into his hands one of the Polaroid photographs of herself and the woman with dark hair. To remember me by. No, is yours. I don't want that one, she said. I have these others. One day you will want it. I'll tell you what. When I'm old, if I need to convince people that I was in the movies, I'll come get it. Okay? She squeezed the picture into his hand, then turned and padded back toward her room and disappeared inside. She closed and latched the door slowly and quietly behind her, like a parent sneaking from the room of a sleeping child. Pasquale stared at the door. He had wished for this world of the glamorous Americans, and like a dream, she had come to his hotel. But now the world was back where it belonged, and he wondered if it would have been better to never have glimpsed what lay beyond the door. Pasquale turned and scuffled up the hall and down the stairs, past the night clerk and outside, to where Tommaso leaned against a wall smoking. His cap was pulled down on his eyes. He showed Tommaso the photo of Dee and the other woman. Tommaso looked at it, then shrugged one shoulder. Bah, he said. And the two men started back toward the marina. Chapter 12. The Tenth Pass. Recently, Los Angeles, California. Before sunrise, before Guatemalan gardeners, before sharks and Benzes and the gentrification of the American mind, Claire feels a hand on her hip. Don't, Daryl, she mutters. Who? She opens her eyes to a blonde wood desk, a flat-screen television, and the kind of painting they put in hotel rooms, because this is a hotel room. She's on her side, and the hand on her hip is coming from behind her. She looks down, sees that she's still dressed, at least they didn't have sex. She rolls over and stares into the big, dewy eyes of Shane Wheeler. She's never awakened in a hotel room next to a man she just met, so she's not quite sure what one says in this situation. Hi, she says. Daryl, is that your boyfriend? He was 10 hours ago. The strip club guy. Good memory. Yeah, she says. At some point in their drunken sharing last night, she had explained how Daryl unapologetically watches online porn all day and goes to strip clubs at night, and then laughs when she suggests this might be disrespectful to her. Hopeless, she recalls describing her relationship. Now, as she lies next to Shane, Claire feels a different sort of hopelessness. What's the matter with her, going back to this guy's room? And what to do with her hands now, which not long ago had been running through Shane's hair and over various parts of his body? She reaches for her silenced BlackBerry, takes a data hit. 7 a.m., 61 degrees, 9 new emails, 2 phone calls, and a simple text message from Daryl. What up? She glances back over her shoulder at Shane again. His hair seems even more unruly than it did last night. His sideburns more late Elvis than alt hipster. His shirt is off, and she can see on his skinny left forearm that damn tattoo, ACT, which she half blames for what happened last night. Only in the movies does such a moment require a boozy flashback. How Michael had her book rooms at the W for Shane and Pasquale. How she drove the Italian to the hotel while Shane followed in his rental car. How Pasquale said he was tired and went to his room. And she apologized to Shane for laughing at his pitch. How he shrugged it off, but in the way people shrug off something that genuinely bothers them. How she said, "No, I really am sorry," and explained that it wasn't him, it was her frustration with the business. How he said he understood, and that he felt like celebrating. So they went to the bar, and she bought him a drink, and gently reminded him that getting a producer interested was only the first step. How he bought the next round of drinks. "I just made 10 grand. I can afford 2 cocktails. And she the one after. And how, amid all those drinks, they'd told their stories. First, the bland, self-serving surface story one tells a stranger. Family, college, career. And then the truth. The pain of Shane's failed marriage, and the rejection of his book of short stories. Claire's seemingly misguided decision to come out of the cocoon of academia, and her anguish over whether to go back in. Shane's painful realization that he was milk-fed veal. Claire's failed quest to make one great film. And then the loud, laugh-until-you-cry sharing, "My boyfriend is a gorgeous zombie who loves strip clubs," and, "I actually live in my parents' basement." And more drinks came, and the commonplace became revelatory. "I like Wilco, and I like Wilco, too." And, "My favorite pizza is Thai," and, "Mine, too." And then Shane rolled up the sleeves on his faux Western shirt, and Claire's eyes fell on that tattoo, so weak for ink. That one word, ACT. And she did. Leaned over in the bar and kissed him. And his hand rose to her cheek while they kissed. Such a simple thing. His hand on her face. But something Daryl never did. And 10 minutes later, they were in his room, sifting through the minibar for more fuel and making out like college kids, her giggling at the tickle of his bushy sideburns, him pausing to compliment her breasts. A sweet, 2-hour, kissing, groping, laughing debate over whether or not to have sex. Him: "I'm leaning toward yes." Her: "I feel like the swing vote." Until they must have fallen asleep. And now, morning after, Claire sits up. "This wasn't very professional of me."
"Depends on your profession."
She laughs.
"If you paid for that, I think you got ripped off."
He puts his hand back on her hip. "There's still time." She laughs, takes his hand from her hip, and sets it on the bed. But she can't say she isn't tempted. The kissing and rolling around were nice enough. She assumes the sex would be good. With Daryl, the sex was the first thing between them, the selling point, the foundation for a whole relationship. But in the last few months, she's felt as if the intimacy has seeped out of it, and now there are 2 distinct phases to sex with Daryl. The first 2 minutes, like an exam from an autistic gynecologist, the next 10, a visit from the Roto-Rooter man. At the very least, she imagines, Shane would be present. Conflicted, confused, she stands to think, or to buy time.
"Where are you going?"
Claire holds up her phone.
see if I still have a boyfriend. I thought you were going to break up with him.
I haven't decided.
I'll decide that for you. I appreciate that, but I should probably take care of it.
And if the porn zombie asks where you were all night?
Guess I'll tell him.
Will he break up with you?
She hears some bit of hopefulness in the question.
I don't know, she says.
She pulls the chair out from the desk, sits, and begins thumbing through the calls and emails on her phone to see when Daryl called last.
Shane sits up too now, swings his feet over the edge of the bed and grabs his shirt off the floor.
She glances up, can't help but smile at his scrawny attractiveness. He's an aging version of the boys she always fell for in college. In the vicinity of good-looking, but a few blocks away. Physically, he's the anti-Daryl, square-jawed Daryl with his 500 push-ups a day chest. Shane all narrow angles and jutting collarbones, just the hint of a roll in his gut.
When exactly did you take your shirt off? She asks.
I'm not sure. I guess I was hoping to start a trend.
She goes back to her BlackBerry, opens Daryl's "What up?" text, and tries to figure out what to type back. Her thumbs hover over the keys, but nothing comes.
So what did you see in this guy? Shane asks.
Originally.
Claire glances up.
What did she see?
It's too corny to say, but she saw all the cliched shit. Stars, flashes of light, babies, a future. She saw all of this the very first night, as they banged through her apartment door, flinging clothes and chewing each other's lips, and reaching and prodding and cupping, and then he lifted her off the ground, and all of her college fumblings became as insignificant as bumping into someone on a stairwell. She felt exactly like she'd never been fully alive before the moment Daryl first touched her. And it wasn't just sex. He was inside her. She'd never really thought about that phrase until that night, when in the middle of it she looked up and saw herself, every bit of herself, in his eyes. Claire shakes the memory off. How could she possibly say any of that, especially here? And so she simply says,
"Abs. I saw abs."
And it's odd. She feels worse for dismissing Daryl as a set of stomach muscles than she does for being in this hotel room with a boy she just met. Shane nods again at the cell phone in her hands.
So, what are you going to tell him?
No idea.
Tell him we're falling in love. That'll end it.
Yeah?
She looks up.
Are we? He smiles as he snaps the buttons on his faux Western shirt.
Maybe.
We could be.
How'll we know if we don't spend the day together?
Impulsive much?
Key to my quirky appeal.
God damn it. She thinks that might be the case. His appeal. She recalls Shane saying that he married the harsh, truth-telling waitress after dating for only a few months. She's not surprised. Who even uses the words falling in love 14 hours after meeting someone? There's something undeniably optimistic about him. And for a moment she wonders if she ever had such a quality.
Can I ask you something? Claire says.
Why the Donner Party?
Oh no, he says.
You're just looking for a laugh again.
I told you I'm sorry about that.
It's just that for 3 years, Michael has rejected every idea I bring in as being too dark, too expensive, too period, not commercial enough. Then you come in yesterday with, no offense, the darkest, least commercial, most expensive period film I've ever heard about, and he loves it. It's just so unlikely. I just wondered where it came from.
Shane shrugs and reaches for one of his socks on the floor.
I have 3 older sisters. All of my early memories are of them. I loved them. I was their toy, like a doll they dressed up. When I was 6 or so, my oldest sister, Olivia, developed an eating disorder. It just about destroyed our family. It was awful. Olivia was 13, and she'd go in the bathroom and throw up. She'd spend her lunch money on diet pills, squirrel food away in her clothes. First, my parents yelled at her, but that did no good. She didn't care. It was like she wanted to waste away. You could see the bones in her arms. Her hair was falling out. My parents tried everything. Therapists and psychologists, inpatient treatment. My ex thinks that's when they really started becoming so overprotective. I don't know. What I remember is lying in bed one night and hearing my mom weep and my father trying to comfort her. Mom just saying over and over, "My baby is starving to death." Shane still has the sock in his hand, but he doesn't put it on. He just stares at it. "What happened?" Claire asks quietly. "Hmm?" He looks up. "Oh, she's fine now. The treatment clicked or something, I guess. Olivia just got over it. She's still got some food hang-ups. She's the sister who never brings food for Thanksgiving, always makes the centerpiece instead. Little pumpkins, cornucopias, and don't even mention the word brownie around her. She came out okay. Married this jackass, but they're happy enough. Have two kids. The funny thing is, the rest of my family never talks about that time. Even Olivia shakes off that whole period like it was nothing. My skinny years, she calls them. But I never got over it. When I was 7 or 8, I'd lie awake at night, praying that if God would make Olivia better, I'd go to church, become a minister, something. And so when it didn't happen right away, you know how kids are, I blamed myself, connected my sister's starving to my own lack of faith. He stares off, rubs the inside of his arm. By high school, Olivia was fine, and I was over my religious phase. But after that, I was always fascinated by stories of starvation and deprivation. I read everything I could find, did my school reports on the siege of Leningrad and the potato famine. I especially liked stories of cannibalism, the Uruguayan rugby team, Alfred Packer, the Maori, and, of course, the Donner Party. Shane looks down and sees the sock in his hands. "I guess I identified with poor William Eddy, who escaped himself, but who could do nothing while his family starved in that awful camp." He absentmindedly puts the sock on. "So when I read in Michael Dean's book how pitching a movie is all about believing in yourself, pitching yourself, it was like a vision. I knew exactly the story I needed to pitch." "A vision? Believing in yourself?" Claire looks down, wondering if this "just do it, dude" confidence is what Michael was actually responding to yesterday, and what had attracted her last night. Hell, maybe they can make Donner, based on nothing more than this kid's passion for it. Passion, another word that sticks in her throat. Claire glances down at her BlackBerry and sees an email from Michael's producing partner, Danny Roth. The subject line is, "Donner." Michael must have called Danny about Shane's pitch. She wonders if Danny had talked some sense into Michael. She opens the email, written in the tortured, hurried, moronic electronic shorthand that Danny somehow believes is saving him great amounts of time. "See, Robert says you're setting up pitch for Universal Monday on Donner. Has to look good. RE contract. See if writer has storyboards or backstory, anything that looks like we're further down the road. Straight faces. Danny." She looks up at Shane sitting on the edge of the bed watching her. She looks back down at Danny's email. "Has to look good? Why would it look good and not be good? And storyboards to make it look like they're further down the road? Straight faces?" Then she recalls Michael's boast yesterday. "I'm going to pitch an 80 million dollar movie about frontier cannibalism." "Ah, shit," she says. "Another text from your boyfriend? Would they really do this?" She recalls Danny and Michael talking about the lawyers looking for a way out of Michael's contract with Universal. What a stupid question. Of course they would do this. They would never not do this. This is what they do. Claire's hand comes to her temple. "What?" Shane stands and she looks over at him, his big doe eyes and those bushy sideburns framing his face. Are you okay?
Claire considers not telling him, letting him have his weekend of triumph. She could just put on blinders and finish out the weekend, help Michael with his doomed pitch and his missing actress, then on Monday accept the cult museum job, start stocking up on cat food. But Shane is staring at her with those moon eyes, and she realizes that she likes him, and that if she's ever going to break away, it has to be now.
Shane, Michael has no intention of making your movie.
What? He laughs a little.
What are you talking about?
She sits on the bed next to him and explains the whole thing, as she sees it now, starting with a deal Michael made with the studio. How at the low point of his career, the studio took on some of Michael's debt in exchange for the rights to some of his old films.
There were two other parts to the deal, she says. Michael got an office on the lot, and the studio got a first look deal, meaning that Michael had to show them all of his ideas and he could only go to other studios if they passed.
Well, the first look was a joke. For 5 years, the studio rejected every script Michael brought in. And when he took those scripts and treatments and books out to other studios, if you already know that Universal has rejected an idea, why would you ever want it? Then came Hook Book. When Michael started developing that idea, he figured a reality show and website was beyond the scope of his contract, which he assumed was for film development only. But it turned out the contract stipulated the studio got the first shot at all material developed in any media. Here was Michael, with this potentially huge unscripted TV business, and it turned out the studio basically owned it.
I don't understand what this has to do with...
Claire holds her hand up. Ever since then, Michael's lawyers have been looking for a way out of the contract. A few weeks ago, they found it. The studio put an escape clause in the contract to protect itself in case Michael wasn't just in a slump, but was totally played out. If Michael brings a certain number of bad ideas over a certain period of time, say the studio doesn't develop 10 straight projects over 5 years, then either side can opt out. But where the contract stipulates all material, the escape clause mentions only films. So even though the studio made Hook Book, if Michael options and develops 10 film ideas in 5 years and the studio passes on all 10, then either side can walk away with no obligation. Shane catches up quickly, his brow furrowing.
So you're saying I am the 10th pass,
Claire says. An $80 million cannibal western. A movie so dark, expensive, and non-commercial that the studio could never say yes to it. Michael will option your idea for nothing, then send you off to write a spec script he has no intention of making. When the studio passes, he'll be free to sell his TV shows to the highest bidder for, I don't know, tens of millions. Shane stares at her. Claire feels awful for telling him, for puncturing the kid's confidence. She puts a hand on his arm.
I'm sorry, Shane, she says.
Then her phone rings. Daryl.
Shit.
She squeezes Shane's arm, stands, and walks across the room, answering without looking at the screen.
Hey,
she says to Daryl. But it's not Daryl. It's Michael Dean.
Claire, good, you're up. Where are you?
He doesn't wait for an answer.
Did you drop the Italian and his translator off at the hotel last night?
She looks over at Shane.
Sort of, she says.
How soon can you meet me at the hotel?
Pretty quickly.
She's never heard Michael's voice like this.
Listen, Michael, she says, we need to talk about Shane's pitch.
But he interrupts her.
We found her,
Michael says.
Who?
Dee Morey. Only her name wasn't Dee Morey. It was Deborah Moore. She was a high school drama and Italian teacher all these years in Seattle. Can you fucking believe it?
Michael sounds hopped up, high.
And her kid. Have you ever heard of a band called The Reticents?
Again, he doesn't wait for her to answer.
Yeah, me neither. Anyway, the investigator worked overnight preparing a file. I'll fill you in on the way to the airport.
Airport? Michael, what's going on?
I have something for you to read on the plane. It will explain it all. Now, go get Mr. Tursi and the translator and tell them to get ready. We fly out at noon.
But, Michael... He's already hung up, though, before Claire can say, Wait, fly out where?
She clicks off the call and looks over at Shane, still sitting on the bed, a distant look on his face.
Michael found his actress, she says. He wants us all to fly off to see her.
Shane doesn't appear to have heard her. He is staring at some point on the wall behind her. She should never have said anything. Should have allowed him to go on living in his little bubble.
Look, I'm sorry, Shane, she says. You don't have to go. I can find another translator. This business, it's...
But he interrupts her.
So, you're saying he pays me $10,000 to get out of his contract?
Shane has the strangest look on his face. It's oddly familiar to Claire.
And then he goes out and makes $10 million?
And now she knows where she recognizes that look from. It's a look she sees every day. The look of someone doing the math, of someone seeing the angles.
Then maybe my movie is worth more than 10,000.
Holy shit. The kid's a natural.
I mean, who wants to go pitch a dead movie idea for 10 grand?
But for 50? Or 80? Shane breaks into a sly smile.
Sign me up.
Chapter 13. D sees a movie. April 1978, Seattle, Washington. She called him P.E. Steve, and he was at that very moment driving across town to pick her up for a date. Deborah Moore Bender had grown adept at deflecting the advances of her fellow teachers. But an attractive young widow was apparently too much for the sturdy Steve to abide. And for weeks he circled until he finally made his move, while they sat together at a desk outside a school dance, checking ASB cards beneath a banner that read, Everlasting Love, Spring into 78. Deborah gave him the usual excuse. She didn't date other teachers. But Steve laughed this off.
What is that, like a lawyer-client thing? Because you know I teach phys ed, right? I'm not a real teacher, Deborah.
Her friend Mona had been urging Deborah to date Steve ever since word of his divorce reached the teacher's lounge. Sweet Mona, whose own romantic life was a series of disasters, but who somehow knew what was best for Deborah. But what really convinced her was that P.E. Steve asked her to a movie. There was this movie she wanted to see. And now, minutes before he was to pick her up, Deborah stood in the bathroom staring into the mirror and running a brush through her feathered blonde hair, which ruffled and settled like water in a boat's wake. Miss Farah, some of the students called her, a name she pretended to dislike. She turned to the side. This new hair color was a mistake. She'd spent a decade fighting the awful vanity of her youth, and she'd really hoped, at 38... to be one of those women who were comfortable with middle age, but she just wasn't there yet. Each gray hair still seemed like a weevil in a flower bed. She glanced at the hairbrush. How many millions of strokes through her hair? How many face washings and sit-ups? How much work had she done, all to hear those words? Beautiful, pretty, foxy. At one time, Deborah accepted her looks without self-consciousness. She didn't need affirmation. No Miss Farah, or leering P.E. Steve, or even awkward sweet Mona. If I looked like you, Deborah, I'd masturbate all the time. But now? Dee set the hairbrush down, staring at it like some kind of talisman. She remembered singing into a brush like that when she was a kid. She still felt like a kid. Like a nervous, needy 15-year-old getting ready for a date. Maybe nerves were natural. Her last relationship had ended a year ago. Her son Pat's guitar teacher, Bald Marv. Pat nicknamed the men in her life. She'd liked Bald Marv. Thought he stood a chance. He was older. In his late 40s. Had two older daughters from a failed marriage. and was keen on blending the families, although he was decidedly less keen after he and Deborah returned home one night to find Pat already blending, in bed with Marv's 15-year-old daughter Janet. During Marv's eruption, she thought about defending Pat. Why do boys always get blamed in these situations? After all, Marv's daughter was 2 years older than him. But this was Pat, and he proudly confessed his elaborate plans like a cornered Bond villain. It had been all his idea, his vodka, his condom. Deborah wasn't surprised that Bald Marv ended it. And while she hated breakups, the disingenuous abstractions, "This is just not where I want to be right now," as if the other person had nothing to do with it. At least Bald Marv stated the case plainly. "I love you, Dee, but I do not have the energy to deal with this shit between you and Pat." You and Pat. Was it really that bad? Maybe. 3 boyfriends ago, coverall Carl, the contractor who worked on her house, had pushed her to get married, but wanted Deborah to put Pat in the military school first. "Jesus, Carl," she'd said. "He's 9 years old." And now, up to bat, P.E. Steve. At least his kids lived with their mother. Maybe this time no civilians would get hurt. She walked down the narrow hallway past Pat's school picture. God, that smirk in every picture. That same cleft chin, wet-eyed, see-me smirk. The only thing that ever changed in his school pictures was his hair. Floppy, permed, zeppelin, spiked. The expression was always there. The dark charisma. Pat's bedroom door was closed. She knocked lightly, but he must have had headphones on because he didn't answer. Pat was 15 now, old enough that she should be able to leave him home alone without some big speech every time she went out, but she couldn't help herself. Deborah knocked again, then opened his bedroom door and saw Pat sitting cross-legged with his guitar across his lap, beneath a Pink Floyd poster of light going through a prism. He was leaning forward, his hand outstretched toward the top drawer of his nightstand, as if he'd just shoved something inside. She pressed into the room, pushing a pile of clothes out of the way. Pat took off the headphones. "Hey, Mom," he said. "What did you put in the drawer?" she asked.
"Nothing,"
Pat said too quickly. "Pat, are you going to make me look in there? No one's making you do anything." On the bottom shelf of his nightstand, she saw the rat-eared, loose pages of Alvis's book, at least the one chapter he'd written. She'd given it to Pat a year ago, after a big fight, during which he'd said he wished he had a father to go live with. "This was your father," she said that night, hoping there was something in the yellowed pages to anchor the boy. "Your father." She'd nearly come to believe it herself. Alvis had always insisted they tell Pat the truth once he got older, when he could understand. But as the years went on, Deborah had no idea how to do that. She crossed her arms, like some picture from a parenting guide. "So are you going to open that drawer, or am I?"
"Seriously, Mom, it's nothing. Trust me."
She moved toward the nightstand, and he sighed, set his guitar down, and opened the drawer. He moved some things around and finally removed a small marijuana pipe.
"I wasn't smoking, I swear."
She felt the pipe, which was cool. No dope in it. She searched the drawer. There was no marijuana. It was just a drawer full of junk. A couple of wristwatches, some guitar picks, his music composition books, pens and pencils.
"I'm keeping the pipe," she said.
"Sure." He nodded, as if that were obvious. "I shouldn't have had it in there." When he got in trouble, he always became strangely calm and reasonable. He'd break into this we're-in-this-together mode that had always disarmed her. It was as if he were helping her deal with a particularly difficult child. He'd had the same quality at 6. One time she'd stepped outside to get the mail, talked to her neighbor, and came back in to find Pat pouring a pan of water on the smoldering couch.
"Wow," he said, as if he'd just discovered the fire rather than set it. Thank God I got to it early. Now he held up the headphones. Subject change. You'd like this song. She looked down at the pipe in her hand. Maybe I shouldn't go out. Come on, Mom. I'm sorry. Sometimes I fiddle around with things when I'm writing. But I haven't gotten high in a month. I swear. Now go on your date. She stared at him, looking for some sign that he was lying. But his eye contact was as unwavering as ever. Maybe you're just looking for an excuse to not go out, Pat said. That was like him, too, to turn it around on her, and to peg it on some real insight. It was true. She probably was looking for an excuse to not go out. Loosen up, he said. Go have fun. I'll tell you what. You can borrow my P.E. clothes. Steve especially likes tight gray shorts. She smiled in spite of herself. I think I'll just go with what I'm wearing, thanks. He's gonna make you shower afterward, you know. You think? Yep. Roll call, stretching, floor hockey, shower. That's P.E. Steve's dream date. Is that so? Yep. The guy's fatuous. Fatuous? That was Pat, too, showing off his vocabulary while calling her date a moron. But don't ask him if he's fatuous, because he'll say, Boy, I hope so. I paid a lot for this vasectomy. She laughed again in spite of herself, and wished, as always, that she hadn't. How much trouble had Pat squirmed out of at school this way? Female teachers were especially helpless. He got A's without books, talked other kids into doing his work, convinced principals to waive rules for him, ditched school and invented fabulous reasons for his absence. Deborah would cringe during school conferences when the teacher asked about her diagnosis, or about Pat's trip to South America, or about the death of his sister. Oh, and his poor father. Murdered. Disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle. Dead of exposure on Everest. Every year, poor Alvis died all over again of some new cause. Then around his 14th birthday, Pat seemed to realize that he didn't need to lie to get things, that it was more effective and more fun to simply look people in the eye and tell them exactly what he wanted. She wondered sometimes if having a father around would have balanced her indulgence of him. She'd been overly charmed by his precociousness when he was little, and probably too lonely, especially in those dark years. Pat set his guitar down and stood up. Hey, I'm kidding about Steve. He seems nice. He walked over. Go. Have fun. Be happy. He really had grown in this last year. Anyone could see it. He'd gotten in less trouble at school, hadn't snuck out of the house, had gotten better grades. Yet she was still discomfited by those eyes, not by their structure or color, but some quality in his stare, what people called a glimmer, a spark, a thrilling, watch this, danger. You really want to make me happy? Deborah said. Be here when I get home. Deal, he said, and stuck out his hand. Okay if Benny comes over to practice? Sure. She shook his hand. Benny was the guitar player Pat had recruited for his band. This was the thing turning Pat around. His band, the Garys. She had to admit, after a couple of school events and a battle of the bands in Seattle Center, the Garys weren't bad. In fact, they were pretty good. Not as punk as she'd feared, but kind of grubby and straightforward. When she'd likened them to Let It Bleed era Stones, Pat rolled his eyes. And her son on stage was a revelation. He sang, preened, growled, joked. He exuded something up there that shouldn't have surprised her, but did. An effortless charm. Power. And ever since the band got together, Pat had been the picture of calm. What does it say about a kid that joining a rock band settles him down? But it was undeniable. He was focused and engaged. His motivation still worried her. He talked a lot about hitting it big, about becoming famous, and so she tried to explain the dangers of fame. But she couldn't really be specific. Could only make flat, bland speeches about the purity of art and the trappings of success. So she worried that her talk was all a waste of time, like warning a starving person about the dangers of obesity. "I'll be home in 3 hours," Deborah said now. It would be 5 or 6 hours, but this was a habit, cutting the time in half so he might get in only half the trouble. "Until then, As she looked for the proper scale of warning, Pat's face broke into a smile, eyes tipping before the corners of his mouth began their slow climb. "Don't do anything?" "Yes, don't do anything." He saluted, smiled, put his headphones back on, grabbed his guitar and plopped back on the bed. "Hey," he said when she turned away. "Don't let Steve talk you into jumping jacks. He likes to watch the jiggly parts." She eased the door closed and had just started down the hallway when she looked down at the pipe in her hands. Now, why would he take a pipe out of its hiding place if he didn't have pot for it? And when she'd asked what he'd been doing, Pat had to dig around in the drawer for the pipe. Wouldn't it be on top if he'd just thrown it in there? She turned in the hallway, went back, and threw the door open. Pat was sitting back on the bed with his guitar, the nightstand dresser open again. Now, though, he had open on the bed the thing he'd actually been hiding from her, his songwriting book. He was bent over it with a pencil. He sat up quickly, red-faced and furious. "What the hell, Mom?" She stalked over and grabbed the notebook from his bed, not really sure what she was looking for, her mind going to that place parents' minds went, worst-case scenario land. "He's writing songs about suicide, about dealing drugs." She flipped to a random page. Song lyrics. A few notations about melody. Pat had only a rudimentary understanding of music. Fragments of sweet, pained lyrics, like any 15-year-old might write. A love song, "Hot Tanya," awkwardly rhymed with "I Want Ya." Some faux meaningful tripe about the sun and moon and eternity's womb. He reached for the notebook. "Put that down!" She flipped forward, looking for whatever had been so dangerous that he'd give her his pot pipe rather than admit he was writing a song. "Fucking put it down, Mom!" She found the last page with writing on it, the song he must have been trying to hide, and her shoulders slumped when she saw the heading. "The Smile of Heaven," the title of Alvis's book. She read the chorus. "I used to believe he'd come back for me. Why is heaven smiling when this shit ain't funny?" Oh, Deborah felt awful. I'm sorry, Pat, I thought. He reached up and took the notebook back. She so rarely saw beneath Pat's smooth, sarcastic surface that she sometimes forgot a boy was there. A hurt boy who was still capable of missing his father, even though he didn't remember him. "Oh, Pat," she said. "You'd rather I thought you were smoking pot than writing a song?" He rubbed his eyes. "It's a bad song." "No, Pat, it's really good." "It's maudlin crap," he said. "And I knew you'd make me talk about it." She sat on the bed. "So? Let's talk about it." "Oh, Jesus." He looked past her at a point on the floor. Then he blinked, laughed, and this seemed to snap him out of some trance. "It's no big deal, it's just a song. Pat, I know it's been hard on you." He winced. "I don't think you understand just how much I don't want to talk about this. Please, can't we talk about it later?" When she didn't budge, Pat pushed her gently with his foot. "Come on. I have more maudlin crap to write, and you're going to be late for your date. And when you're tardy, P.E. Steve makes you run laps." P.E. Steve drove a Plymouth Duster with deep bucket seats. He had a gone-to-seed superhero look, with blocky side-parted hair and a square jaw,
and an athletic body just starting to swell with middle age. Men have a half-life, she thought, like uranium.
What should we see?
Steve asked her in the car. She felt ridiculous even saying it. The Exorcist too, she shrugged. I heard some kids in the library talking about it. It sounded good.
Fine with me. I figured you more for a foreign film buff, something with subtitles that I'd have to pretend to understand.
Deborah laughed. It has a good cast, she said. Linda Blair, Louise Fletcher, James Earl Jones. She could barely even say the real name. Richard Burton.
Richard Burton? Isn't he dead?
Not yet, she said.
Okay,
P.E. Steve said.
But you might have to hold my hand. The first Exorcist scared the shit out of me.
She looked out the window. I didn't see it. They ate dinner at a seafood place, and she noted when he took one of her shrimp without asking. The conversation was easy and casual. Steve asking about Pat, Deborah saying that he was doing better. Funny how every conversation about Pat assumed a baseline of trouble.
You shouldn't worry about him, Steve said, as if reading her mind. He's a lousy floor hockey player, but he's a good kid. The talented ones like that, the more trouble they get in, the more successful they are as adults.
How do you know that?
'Cause I never got in trouble, and now I'm a PE teacher.
No, this wasn't bad at all. They sat early in the theater with a shared box of dots and a shared armrest, and shared backgrounds. She, widowed a decade earlier, mother dead, dad remarried, younger brother and two sisters. He, divorced, two kids, two brothers, parents in Arizona. Shared gossip, too. The one about some kids discovering a cache of the shop teacher's raunchy porn above the lathe. He.
I guess that's why they call it wood shop.
And Mrs. Wiley seducing the gearhead Dave Ames. She. But Dave Ames is just a boy. He.
Yeah, not anymore.
Then the lights went down and they settled into their seats, P.E. Steve leaning over and whispering.
You seem different from how you are at school.
How am I at school? She asked.
Honestly, you're kind of scary.
She laughed. Kind of scary?
No, I didn't mean kinda. Completely scary. Utterly intimidating.
I'm intimidating?
Yeah, I mean, look at you. You have seen yourself in a mirror, right?
She was saved from the rest of this conversation by the coming attractions. Afterward, she leaned forward with anticipation, feeling the buzz she always felt when one of his films started. This one started with a mash of fire and locusts and devils, and when he finally came on, she felt both exhilaration and sadness. His face was grayer, ruddier, and his eyes, a version of those eyes she saw every day at home, but now like burned-out bulbs, the spark almost gone. The movie swung from stupid to silly to incomprehensible, and she wondered if it would make more sense to someone who'd seen the first Exorcist. Pat had snuck into a theater to see it and pronounced it hilarious. The plot employed some kind of hypnosis machine made of Frankenstein wires and suction cups, which appeared to allow two or three people to have the same dream. When he wasn't on screen, she tried to concentrate on the other actors, to catch bits of business, interesting decisions. Sometimes, when she watched his films, she'd think about how she would have played a particular scene across from him, as she instructed her students, to notice the choices the actors made. Louise Fletcher was in this movie, and Deborah marveled at her easy proficiency. Now there was an interesting career, Louise Fletcher's. Dee could have had that kind of career. Maybe.
We can leave if you want,
P.E. Steve whispered.
What?
No, why?
You keep scoffing.
Do I?
I'm sorry.
The rest of the movie she sat quietly, with her hands in her lap, watching as he struggled through ridiculous scenes, trying to find something to do with this dreck. A few times she did see bits of his old power crack through, the slight trill in that smooth voice overcoming his boozy diction. They were quiet, walking to the car.
Steve, that was interesting.
Deborah, hmm. On the way home, she stared out her window, lost in thought. She replayed her conversation with Pat earlier, wondering if she hadn't missed some important opening. What if she'd just come out and told him? Oh, by the way, I'm on my way to see a movie starring your real father. But could she imagine a scenario in which that information helped Pat? What was he going to do? Go play catch with Richard Burton?
I hope you didn't pick that movie on purpose, said P.E. Steve.
What? She squirmed in the seat. I'm sorry?
Well, just that it's hard to ask someone out for a second date after a movie like that. Like asking someone to go on another cruise after the Titanic.
She laughed, but it was hollow. She pretended to herself that she went to all of his movies and kept an eye on his career because of Pat, in case it made sense to tell him one day. But she could never tell him. She knew that. So if it wasn't for Pat, why did she still go to the movies and sit there like a spy watching him destroy himself, daydreaming herself into supporting roles, never the Liz parts, always Louise Fletcher. Although it was never her, of course, not Deborah Moore, the high school drama and Italian teacher, but the woman she'd tried to create all those years ago, Dee More, as if she'd cleaved herself in two, Deborah coming back to Seattle, Dee waking up in that tiny hotel on the Italian coast and getting sweet, shy Pasquale to take her to Switzerland, where she would do what they'd wanted, trade a baby for a career. And it was that career she still fantasized about. After 26 movies and countless plays, the veteran finally gets a supporting actress nomination. In the bucket seat of P.E. Steve's duster, Deborah sighed. God, she was pathetic. A schoolgirl forever singing into hairbrushes.
You okay?
P.E. Steve said.
It's like you're 50 miles away.
I'm sorry. She looked over and squeezed his arm. I had this weird conversation with Pat before I left. I guess I'm still upset about it.
You want to talk about it?
She almost laughed at the idea, confessing the whole thing to Pat's P.E. teacher. Thanks, she said. But no. Steve went back to driving, and Deborah wondered if such a man's matter-of-fact ease could still have some effect on the 15-year-old Pat, or if it was too late for all of that. They pulled up to her house, and Steve turned off the car. She wouldn't mind going out with him again. But she hated this part of dates. The turn in the driver's seat, the awkward seeking out of eyes, the fitful kiss and request to see her again. She glanced over at the house to make sure Pat wasn't watching. No way she could stand him teasing her about a goodbye kiss. And that's when she saw something was missing. She got out of the car as if in a trance, started walking toward the house.
So that's it?
She glanced over to see that P.E. Steve had gotten out of the car.
What?
She said.
Look, he said. This might not be my place, but I'm just going to say it. I like you.
He leaned on the car, his arm propped on his open door.
You asked me what you were like at school, and honestly, you're like you've been the last hour. I said you were intimidating because of the way you look, and you are. But sometimes it's like you're not even in the room with other people. Like no one else even exists.
Steve, but he wasn't done.
I know I'm not your type. That's fine. But I think you might be a happier person if you let people in sometimes.
She opened her mouth to tell him why she'd gotten out of the car, but you might be a happier person pissed her off. She might be a happier person? She might be a... Jesus. She stood there silently, broken, seething.
Well, good night.
Steve got in his duster, closed the door, and drove away. She watched his car turn at the end of the street, taillights blinking once. Then she looked back at her house, and the empty driveway, where her car should have been parked. Inside, she opened the drawer where she kept the spare car keys, gone, of course, peeked in Pat's bedroom, empty.